Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Arboreality by Rebecca Campbell, narrated by Cynthia Farrell. Special Collections. Jude had been teaching engineering communication and design online for so long that the temporary virtual classroom seemed permanent. Every year or two, someone in the department brought up in-person classes, but he wasn't surprised when the state of emergency extended another year, and they continued to wait for a return to normal that never came. Though he rarely visited his office, he still needed books for his own work, which he sent out regularly to 18th Century Speculum. So he went into campus on a wet Tuesday, passing darkened condo towers that had once been gilded and brilliant. When he was an undergrad, back in the 90s, the campus had been richly forested. Now the rhododendrons were dying, while blackberries advanced from the forest's edge to the university club. He missed the familiar markers of his own early education. Drum circles, atrocity exhibits, chalk lines that purported to show the sea levels of 2100. Once he'd got absurdly high and fallen asleep in the middle of the quad with Discipline and Punish open on his chest, the day rising and falling around him. It was 5 before he crawled back to the bus loop, the book sunburned into his skin. That earlier age was incredible to his students, even horrible. Frivolity bought at a terrible cost, while they finished degrees in disaster management and experimental agriculture with placements in the swamplands of the former tundra, digging in to survive what the world would soon become if they didn't first save it. He was used to their increasingly angry questions, delivered via email or in chat. Why would subject-verb agreement matter when I want to do quality control at a nuclear power plant? What does ethos even mean if I'm installing photovoltaic arrays on the highway to Fort Mac or building a wind farm on Lake Erie? 20 years before, he had lectured them about communication standards in complex infrastructure projects and told them that they would spend their entire careers writing and that they should learn to do it well. But now, Jude had no answer that meant anything to them. The light switch in the hallway didn't work. A poster on the bulletin board outside his office advertised a lecture that had taken place 6 years before. He had meant to attend. He had not. Miraculously, the library was open. Inside, he began climbing the stairs to the stacks. "You!" He turned and saw a woman silhouetted in the light from the entrance. Her hands were full. Ice cream buckets, cleaning buckets, one with the old Canadian Tire logo.
"Go on," she said as she passed him. "Upstairs, while there's time. It's breaking through in the southwest corner. We're going to lose all of Deleuze and Guattari."
Without speaking, he accepted the buckets she pushed into his hands and followed her. It had been a long time since he'd chatted with someone by accident, nodding as they traveled one way or the other, a promise of coffee later. He realized that he had not yet spoken and asked,
"You've been coming in every day?"
"More or less. What are you looking for?"
"Oh."
He had to think, staring at the stack of ice cream buckets in his arms.
"Volume 7 of the Twickenham Pope."
It was good to chat, as people had done before the world grew so dire, and all contact had the quality of risk, and all the concatenated sorrows of the world seemed to drain away the pleasure of conversation from young people.
"Why are we carrying buckets?"
They reached the top floor, where he saw a broken window someone had mended with garbage bags and cardboard. Berenice, that was her name. A PhD in information theory from some big American school. She led him to a corner where the ceiling was swollen and blackened.
"It's probably been collecting for weeks, but it only broke through today." I'll be emptying buckets all night. The air smelled of stale paper, swollen with damp. Among the dull, earthy scents, though, a filament of freshness. Rain. He'd never smelled rain in here before.
PR3620.F03,
she called over her shoulder. Of course, he said, setting down the buckets and walking through the stacks to PR3620. His footsteps seemed so loud he walked carefully, as though he might disturb the students who no longer visited the sunny corner at the far end, with a bench on which one could, if one got there early enough, stretch out to nap. It was almost dry in the PR3600s. He remembered, suddenly, fighting with a girlfriend in that corner, shout-whispering insults at one another until some midterm stress case shushed them. The Twickenham Pope had survived, rippled with damp. The brief illusion of normalcy vanished. He might turn a corner and find ducks drifting in a study carol, or a waterfall flowing down the emergency stairs. Downstairs, Berenice was sitting at a desk near the window, chaotic with paper, her laptop glowing.
"Don't they know?"
he said, putting down the books.
"I've sent memoranda, but there's no money, and I'm not even sure there's anyone to answer them. I imagine they're building up somewhere, a giant inbox full of unread messages detailing the total collapse of McPherson Library."
"It's just you, then?"
"I have a few student volunteers. Some faculty come in. Do you remember Dr. Cho, the Miltonist? He was the one who snaked the drains in the basement during that really heavy rain in September. The poor man was soaked through for days, but he managed it. I couldn't have done it."
He sat on the dusty plastic chair beside her desk.
"What are we going to do?"
He felt helpless asking, and heard the mild accusation in his voice, unwarranted. She spoke as though prepared for the question, and answered painfully, truthfully.
"It's not going to survive as a collection. There are retired faculty who will help, and students still in town. I've been working on a list. We'll need records and a plan for distributing copies in a number of places. We should assume a great deal of loss."
As though he didn't grasp what she said, he went on.
"I could help you with some of the leaks. We could go up through the ceiling.
But there's no saving the building."
She said this surprisingly gently.
"Not if we're thinking ahead. And we should think farther ahead than next semester or next year. Even if the satellites work, connectivity will only get spottier. Think about what happened after the last landslide in the interior. We're going to need books again, for a while at least. Maybe forever. But we can't if they're all turned to mush and locked away on campus."
"What do we save? Beyond Pope, obviously."
"Pope and animal husbandry. Geography. Geology. How to extract teeth. How to run a homestead."
This time she laughed.
"A homestead."
Jude felt cold, but it was not a new chill. It had been with him for years now. It crept under his skin as he understood that the world he had been made for was disintegrating around him. He'd be left behind with it, dreaming of coffee shops and Wi-Fi, while all the children adapted to a new forest, even now overtaking the abandoned condominiums at the margins of the city. During the first winter of their conspiracy, Jude felt both elation and exhaustion. Despite Dr. Cho's ingenuity, they lost the basement in the April rains and locked the doors permanently on the gallery, the old compact shelving, and the microfiche. The library was crumbling, and the Trans-Mountain connections to exchanges in Alberta were increasingly unreliable with each flood and landslide. But then he thought of how it felt to read Kindred
and the Fleece, and a thousand other books, and his heart was tender and brilliant with hope. He considered the undigitized audio tapes in the archive downtown, at sea level, all those voices, and wondered what would happen to them. Imagine those basement rooms below the old museum flooding, the weeping concrete walls, the long tables and white gloves and tiny pencils, the coat check room, all ankle-deep in water. Then knee-deep, and the watery darkness glowing slightly, with some as yet unevolved phytoplankton that thrived on dissolved concrete. Twice a week, Jude walked the stacks with lists he'd made on the backs of old essays. For the first time in years, he felt rich, profligate, pulling books from the shelves and packing them up to find their way out into the world. The tide pool holds 2.35 liters of salt water, cupped in a massive deposit of quartz diorite on the western shore of Saanich Inlet. The pool has been here since the morning of 26 January 1700, when the last megathrust earthquake shook it into place. The 2.35 liters are refreshed every 12 hours and 24 minutes by a new tide spilling over its lower, southeast-facing lip. In three centuries, it has shared the inlet with ocean gardens full of mussels, middens, beach parties, clear-cut logging and industrial fishing, ocean acidification, jet skis, and salmon runs. In that time, life in the pool has presided, from a distance, over the fashion for pompadours on men and scandalous two-piece bathing suits on women. It has held sea snails, barnacles, limpets, and hermit crabs who feed on the rich biofilm that coats its walls. This day in July is so still the water hardly moves, and the air seems to hang from the branches of arbutus trees above the little pool. At 2 in the afternoon, the temperature reaches 31 degrees Celsius. Granite doesn't mind, of course, but the evaporating water leaves a thin salt crush on the edges of the pool. For a week, every consecutive afternoon is hotter than the one before. 32, 35. People in the Cowichan Valley rise early to soak their curtains before they withdraw into the darkness. 37. The woods are dry. The deer so still they seem already heat-stroked. The rabbits have all disappeared. From Tacoma to Port Hardy, high pressure drives the cloud cover away, further compresses and heats the atmosphere. 39. 42. To people standing on concrete in the treeless neighborhoods, the air feels like insulating glass, thick and darkly gold. The blue sky is hot to the glance. 43, 46. In Victoria, a poor girl renting a crooked room dreams of rain. The grid flickers and fails one night. The beaches are full of strangers, sleeping side by side in the darkness. 12 children die on the first night, and 43 terminally ill people in a nursing home. Those families who can afford it flee to an air-conditioned movie theater outside of town that's showing director's cuts of The Lord of the Rings, and children fall asleep across their parents' laps, sticky with treats, begging to go home to bed. In the early mornings, the water and the rocks around it are cool. The barnacles are attached by their heads to the ground, using the cement they excrete to attach themselves and build their outer shells. By noon, the water is hot to the touch, 51 degrees Celsius, and in the long, still afternoon that follows, proteins in the barnacles' bodies denature. Cells can no longer undertake the necessary functions of life. At low tide, the whole beach smells of rot, the open mouths of mussels. In Victoria, an 85-year-old woman in an apartment on Fort Street with south-facing windows sees the sunrise and thinks, "This day will be unendurable." She is already dehydrated, her blood thickening in her body. It is 47 degrees in her tiny, airless room. She has sprayed the curtains down with warm tap water. She sits near the window, her legs too swollen to walk, and thinks of a day in 1945 when she was small and standing in a tide pool in the rock that underlies Saanich Inlet. It is 48 degrees in her apartment. She thinks of water, of climbing onto barnacled rocks. 49 degrees. It is 50 degrees. She should be careful not to cut herself, but the water around her foot is already stained red. In her brain, the thickened blood clots. She's bleeding. She's bleeding. Rainy days when the scent of water rose from the basement. Stifling days when climbing the stairs was like ascending to hell. Smoke-filled days and dark days when the grid flickered and he wondered if it would ever stabilize. On all these days, Jude collected books and carried them out of the library, where Berenice's old car waited, and together they delivered them to sympathetic homes all over the city. Soil science, animal husbandry, first aid, diseases of the chicken, duck, and pig, love and rockets, diseases of the potato and the principles of distilling, the dangers of methanol, natural dyes, the fairy queen, optics, the signs of stroke, diabetes, the bloody history of empire in North America, the immune system, beneficial molds, dangerous molds, the history of the kayak, the lost megafauna of North America, Coast Salish architecture and principles of construction. But there were far more books than there were places to safely send them, now that the fires had overtaken Sook and the great desettlement of Vancouver Island had begun. Each year, Jude grew more selective. Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata, or Where Does That River Run, or Don't Get Around Much Anymore, or Gymnopédie No. 1, or Company. An oral history of West Coast punk, or a decent survey of the Second World War. The Seven Lamps of Architecture, or The Souls of Black Folk. The Bhagavad Gita, or Journey into the West, or War and Peace. Crystal radio sets. Hydriotaphia, Urn Burial. Or A Discourse of the Sepulchral Urns Lately Found in Norfolk. Morse Code, The Lymphatic System, Bodies That Matter. A Biography of the Sarasate, The History of the Violin and Principles of Its Construction. Joinery, Wagoya, The Construction of Hammers, Both Metal and Stone. He wondered what he had denied the future. Some fact they would need in 20 years. How to mend a photovoltaic plate, or set a leg, or cure croup, or make a smoker. He was tired, cold in the damp, sunless hall. But on this day in January, several years after he and Berenice had begun dismantling the collection, he stopped in at SB 469-476.4, Landscape Architecture. From the shelf, he pulled a book full of diagrams and photographs of trees. Coppicing and inosculation. Pleached Italian hedges and espaliered peaches in a Provençal gardens. Tonslinden in German villages and Baubotanic towers in Denmark. The living root bridges of Meghalaya. Bleachers of rubber fig roots, from which young men craned their necks to watch cricket matches. Furniture not made of wood, but grown from the branches of living trees. He could imagine, suddenly, a future world in which these were ordinary. Lives lived in the branches and among the leaves. The book was too heavy, as Berenice had put it, to carry with you if you were fleeing a plague or a flood. But nevertheless, he packed it in a box bound for a friend in the Cowichan Valley, who had volunteered a whole room to the cause. He'd known Berenice for decades, her rigor and advocacy and bone-dry humor. Daily now, he was relieved to know she was still in town instead of moving east or north to the huge mining towns, where people could gather at cafes in the black fly summers and watch the smoke rise above the wildfires. She could have gone. Her oldest son was a mining engineer. There'd be grandchildren. But Berenice was still here with her ironic smile, reserved for snotty grad students and overreaching administrators.
"Did you hear?"
Berenice told him when they met.
"U of T scooped the first quarto from the legislature library. I'm not surprised. That's U of T all over."
He laughed.
"Maybe we can be greedy, too. What do you want?"
They were on the third floor, white-gloved in the flickering light of the three remaining fluorescent tubes in the ceiling.
"I shouldn't."
It hurt to hear that.
"I thought it should stay nearby. We'll want to reassemble it when..."
That stopped him. He tried again.
"It should probably go out to Cowichan as well."
He picked up a 19th-century chart of the Salish Sea, one of many they had taken before the basement flooded, left behind when U of T cleaned out special collections.
"You should take it,"
Berenice said.
"I have too much already. If my house goes, we'll lose most of the 18th century."
"But there should be some reward, shouldn't there? Take the charts."
That night the power failed, and he looked at the old charts and remembered the shape of the islands as they had once been, from Desolation Sound to Oak Harbor. Now the mouth of the Fraser gaped wider across Delta, and Lulu Island had begun to drop under the water. Saltchuck rushing northeast to overtake the old coastline of False Creek. The Museum of Anthropology at UBC sliding down the sand cliffs to Wreck Beach. He traced the old parameters of the world, as he had known it, as a kid, as a young man, and touched the intersection in Kitsilano he'd loved on warm evenings. His apartment on Fraser Street, in the attic of a rotting house full of squirrels. Buteau seminar rooms. These ghostly and irrelevant maps, he thought, are they even worth preserving? The old folds, the wear marks, the annotations in a fine inky hand. He rolled them up, then set them in his old backpack, open at the top like a quiver of arrows. Dr. Tremblay had taught him geography. He had been a kind man. He now lived with his grandchildren on the shoulder of Mount Newton, above the low-lying suburbs of the Saanich Peninsula. Jude had plugged the address into one of those apps that showed you future coastlines after 1 meter or 10, and it was safer than many places in Victoria. The day was dusty and quiet. That was, he thought, an unexpected benefit of this slow apocalypse. No more drum circles or movie sets to avoid while crossing campus. He had come to enjoy the permanent Sunday afternoon silence that now occupied the whole city. He stowed the maps in his backpack and set off slowly into the smoky air. It took him 3 hours to get to the gate with the golden arbutus, and the driveway was so steep he got off his bike and walked.
"I've never seen golden arbutus," Jude said at the front door.
Tremblay did not invite him inside, but sat with him as he drank a glass of water on the porch. Somewhere the grandchildren were playing.
"I'm not sure where it came from. Some mutation, or maybe one of the genetic modification projects Guillaume did in forestry. He brought them home sometimes. He's 3 years now. The most recent plague." "I'm sorry to hear that. You're teaching from home, I imagine, since the latest?" "I am. What are the plans to reopen?"
It wasn't a question anyone asked anymore. He said,
Someone suggested it would end this year, but that doesn't seem likely.
The sky turned purple in the west. Smoke stained the last sunlight a rich, dark amber. Together they looked down the hillside through drying cedar trees and the dead branches of drought-stressed arbutus.
"Do you know," Dr. Tremblay said, "that an arbutus tree saved the Saanich people during the flood?" "Flood last year? When Elk Lake?" "No. The Great Flood."
Jude listened with pleasure, like it was a digression on Salish mythic hydrology in some first-year geography lecture.
"Anyway, the waters were rising and had covered the village, so they got into their canoes and set off for the only peak still visible, Mount Newton, right here. By the time they reached it, the only thing above the water was an arbutus tree. That's how they didn't lose one another. They tied their canoes to a tree at the top of this mountain until the waters abated."
"One of these?"
Jude asked, looking at the golden trunk below him.
"The old kind, there. Arbutus menziesis. Not the new kind, whatever that is."
Jude did not mention the obvious lesson, that this arbutus was dying. He let the thought pass and asked,
"Could I trouble you for another glass of water?" "It's a beautiful tree,"
Tremblay said.
"Excellent firewood, though not much use in woodworking."
Jude swallowed dryly. Perhaps Tremblay hadn't heard his question. He lifted the old charts from his backpack and said,
"Berenice and I thought you should have these." "Berenice? Who's that?" "Dr. Alexiou." "I don't know an Alexiou." "McPherson Library is falling apart. We're trying to save what we can, and we thought of you. U of T removed everything of value for the duration." "Not everything. There's a lot still there, and the roof won't last many more years. We decided to save what we could."
As Jude unrolled one of the charts, Tremblay seemed suddenly energized, as he had once been at the head of lecture halls and conference rooms.
"This is... You should have been more careful, Jude. What were you thinking? A bicycle."
Tremblay clucked, then carefully turned the pages, using his sleeve to protect them from his fingers.
"You took these? I didn't think you were..."
Jude looked longingly at the empty glass while Tremblay harangued him. He was surprised by his own exhausted patience with the old man's rage. Tremblay belonged to those earlier years, a campus that was green and full of students, voluble conversations at conferences, long dinners at twilight patios downtown. All his work had been undertaken in hope, trusting that the institution would still exist to preserve his books. The Hauntological Coast, Psychogeography of a Canadian Empire. Those books had been a pleasure to read, generously illustrated and printed on heavy paper. He'd included them in a box he'd sent up island, with books about animal husbandry and plate tectonics. Tremblay was boiling now.
"I'll call them, Jude. I'll tell them what you've stolen. What did you think I'd do when you brought me this?"
He thought of Berenice under the steady drip of rain through the holes in the roof, and Dr. Cho soaked to the skin, clearing the drains. He nodded.
"If you like. More than anything, I hope you'll take care of them until someone can come for them."
Jude coasted down the winding driveway among the dying cedar and arbutus. Before he turned onto Mount Newton Crossroad, he stopped and wondered if he could get water at one of the other houses, then dismissed the thought. That was when he saw another golden-leafed arbutus, glowing richly as the sun set. The tree was both familiar, its long, searching trunks, its smooth bark, and alien in its color, which shone in the dying light as though it had gathered the sunset to its skin, and shed it again as evening.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?